Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, descending to darkness once again to take you inside the harrowing psychology inherent within the brutal murders of 32-year-old Roger Atkinson and his 22-year-old lover, Rose Burkert, at the Amana Holiday Inn, located in Williamsburg, Iowa, back on September 12, 1980. Now, there are multiple suspects in this case, and all of them viable, but I'm going to take you down the road I think leads to the truth. But again, there are multiple suspects, and any one of them could be the killer. Now, Roger grew up in a devout Christian family, and later served in the military, going overseas to join the conflict in Vietnam. He soon met his wife, Marcella, also a devout Christian, and the two ultimately settled in St. Joseph, Missouri, where they lived with their daughter at the time of the murders in 1980. Roger was employed at a company called GTE, or General Telephone, as an installer responsible for setting up phone lines and similar sources of communication. While working here, Roger allegedly indulged a decisively male culture that involved intentionally making mistakes on installations where attractive young women would be vulnerable to the charms of a returning repairman looking to fix what's broken. Not only did these efforts resonate strongly on a symbolic level with potential lovers, but from a more practical standpoint, Roger also seems to have been a good-looking guy who would be successful at it. Accordingly, while Roger seems to have met and perhaps engaged romantically with a number of women through using this deceptive method, it also stands to reason that this is the type of behavior that could get him in trouble one day, especially with a jealous or enraged husband. Now, supposedly, this faulty installation technique is exactly the way Roger meets Rose, who was a single mother of a 2-year-old at the time, but one with a past that reveals she was likely being stalked in 1980 by a former boyfriend. Roger, of course, is a family man, one who sings in the church choir and teaches Sunday school, somebody seemingly harmless in comparison, and Rose, training to be a nurse at nearby Methodist hospital, clearly sees him as a good guy. But let's get real for a minute. A man who enters your home and makes faulty repairs under false pretenses to try to sleep with you, while his wife waits in ignorance at home, is the definition of a sociopath, even if he has no violent intentions. In fact, people like this more often bring violent intentions into their lives by way of outside parties they've burned with their irresponsible, entitled behavior. For every secretive, happy and lust couple thrilled to be secretly enjoying the affair, there are undoubtedly people on the other side of the equation, such as spouses, getting hurt by their clandestine actions. So, what obviously happens is that these people make a great effort to keep their loved ones in ignorance under the guise of not wanting to hurt them. Yet, if they didn't want to cause pain in the first place, then cheating on their spouse and lying about it incessantly to cover it up is truly ironic. It says, "You won't get hurt if you don't know, so I need to badly deceive you. I must make a fool of you. I need to do this behind your back. You suffer." So the theme becomes this: I need to keep the secret or you'll get hurt. Yet, if the person finds out, what happens? They get hurt, right? But how? Emotionally. Now, if someone employed sociopathic measures against you to prevent you from getting hurt emotionally through ignorance, then the mirrored version of that, displayed as revenge, would be taking sociopathic measures to ensure that you get hurt physically in a situation in which you were ignorant. It restores balance. It makes things even. So if you cheat by secretly getting together with someone else, hurting a person emotionally, the result might be that the person secretly plots to split you apart physically. So in this crime, what we should see is a murder weapon that specifically implores the notion of splitting one thing or a single entity, like a marriage, into two parts. And we will. More on that soon. So on this weekend, Roger and Rose are excited because they're going away for the whole weekend, meaning they have two nights in which they don't have to be accountable to anybody's prying eyes. But again, think about that. The extent to which you need to deceive an outside party is also the degree to which they need to remain ignorant. If you go to a lover's apartment for a couple of hours after work, this is something that is more easily explained, as sometimes we do find ourselves working unexpectedly late due to unforeseen circumstances. Over time, however, combined with the sheer number of instances for which you need to be covered, your audacity grows just like it would in any other relationship. People start talking about taking the next step, like going away together for the weekend on a little vacation. And as you extend yourself into that place in which the excuses become greater, both in number and in the amount of information needed to be concealed, the load begins to become unmanageable, and people who were actually fooling their significant others turn into fools who don't realize the elephant is in the room already. They keep pushing forward into getting more and more out of the affair because it means they have less and less exposure to what's bothering them at home. But there comes a tipping point in which the spouse suffering the fallout of lies, even if in denial, can deny it no more. So here, in September 1980, Roger and Rose are excited to take this road trip in Rose's Chevy Malibu, as they'll be alone for the weekend. They'll end up about a four-hour drive from home, manifesting the increased emotional distance they want from others, along with defining the amount of ignorance required for this to be a success. They take Interstate 80, a major cross-country roadway, and arrive at the Amana Holiday Inn, located in Williamsburg, Iowa, on the evening of September 12, 1980. Now, we get a great symbolic moment here as they arrive, which sums up who they are in this moment. The hotel, to their dismay, is absolutely booked, 100%, something they didn't expect as they had not made a reservation. In truth, this place normally wouldn't be completely full on a Friday night, but there was a mortuary convention in town, and ironically enough, this hotel will be packed with morticians at the time of the murders. So, accordingly, the parking lot is full, and Roger and Rose decide to simply park in a disabled spot. Now, think of disabilities. What are the two elements that define the limitations of a disability, more or less? Well, a disability normally creates a result lending itself to one of two things. Physical inability, meaning the disability prevents you from being able to do something in the form of action, or doing it efficiently, and the other is ignorance, meaning that a disability, such as being deaf or blind, would prevent you from obtaining information related to those particular senses. Now, in our narrative here, at least symbolically, the disabled person, so to speak, is the spouse, specifically Roger's wife, who by way of his deception is essentially intended to be left ignorant of what's actually happening and unable to physically accommodate because of that reality. So Roger's and Rose's deception intends to limit both the knowledge in terms of awareness and by extension the spouse's physical movements. Essentially, they have conspired to quote-unquote disable the spouse in a manner that allows Rose to temporarily take her spot. So when they arrive to the hotel, just like the marriage is full and has no room for anyone else, Rose makes a spot for herself by parking her car in someone else's spot, specifically the disabled person, who is symbolically consistent with the ignorant spouse who doesn't know what they're going to do and can't physically get to them. Roger and Rose will use that entitlement to allow Rose to park there. But again, if the hotel is symbolic of the couple's marriage, then what we need is someone in that hotel to tell them they can't do that. That will be a talisman, a warning along the way of what's to come. So an employee tells Rose that she needs to move her car to a different spot, one that is not disabled, because the lovers decided it was okay to just leave it there all night. Notice the same ignorance of not realizing their entitlement and ignoring the fact that it might cause someone else harm. It might push somebody out of the way and leave them without a spot. Think about this. Let's say the vehicle is in a disabled spot and somebody disabled shows up to park there only to learn there's no room for them because Roger and Rose are now occupying that space instead, even though they shouldn't be doing it because it's contrary to the rules. The hotel employee is clearly stating, you cannot take that spot. It's not for you. You have to move because someone disabled, aka the spouse left in ignorance, should be the party with permission to occupy it, even if she's not around at the time, just like the spouse is left back at home. So after initially being told the hotel is fully booked, the clerk realizes they've had a single cancellation and are able to offer a room with a king-sized bed on the top floor, or second floor of the hotel, which is room 260. Room 260 is unique in that it's at the end of the hallway and only bordered by one other room, meaning the other side comprises the outside wall on that end of the building. This was back during a time in which road trips were a big deal, and stopping at a hotel was supposed to be an experience of some type, rather than just a place to rest your head for a night. So this Holiday Inn is decorated with a theme perhaps typical of a Midwestern location, and has farming equipment or instruments hung on the walls throughout the hotel. Keep that in mind for now. Here's where the story gets a little confusing in terms of what actually happened. Some reports have them going right to their room and remaining there, while others have them going down to the bar to drink. In the latter narrative, it's said that Rose got into an argument with the bartender, after which the couple went back upstairs to their room again. More on that soon. Either way, while in the room that evening, three phone calls were either made or received, with only one being attributed to an unknown source. Rose had both called her babysitter Shirley and received a call back from her. However, it seems the last or third call was unknown. Who was that? Now, at some point after that final call, the couple is murdered. There was no noise that led anyone to be aware of the killings, to our knowledge. There were no complaints to management, and those in rooms nearby didn't seem to hear anything suspicious. Therefore, it's difficult to place the time of death, and the autopsy doesn't seem to clarify beyond suggesting it's simply the night of September 12th. It seemed that the couple had been murdered 4 hours after their last meal, but nobody can account for when, or even what, they ate during that time. They arrived at the hotel at approximately 7:45 p.m. that evening, so we assume they ate dinner prior to that. While I did notice one suggestion that the couple ordered room service that night, what I can say is that there are no dining carts or similar in the room after the fact, according to our knowledge. So let's break down the room design now, in preparation for discovery of the bodies. As you enter room 260, you find yourself in a short hallway running along the right side of the room. Along that hallway, specifically on the left side of it, you have a closet, followed by a bathroom just past that. The hallway containing the closet and bathroom doors leads straight ahead into the main part of the room. On the right, against the wall in that main area, you have a TV on a swiveling stand, followed by a desk with a chair, and finally, nearing the far wall, a table that also offers two chairs. That's the right side of the room. On the left side, facing those items, we have a king-sized bed at center, flanked by a nightstand with lamp on either side of the bed. There are windows on that far wall, opposite the door, but as far as we know, the heavy drapes were drawn closed at night. Now, the Do Not Disturb sign had been left on the door for the maids to see the next morning, and when the hotel both knocked and called in regard to getting into the room to perform service, their efforts were ignored. By perhaps 1:15 p.m. on September 13th, the maids need to get in there, as the couple had only booked the room for one night and were overdue to check out. So they enter the room using a spare key and calling out to warn anybody inside that they're coming. But once they do, they see a pair of feet hanging off the bed and retreat, believing not that this person is dead, but simply asleep. Again, the curtains are drawn and the room is very dark. Soon after, however, they enter again because their efforts were fruitless and still get no response from the couple. But as they walk the short hallway to the main area, getting closer in the low light, they suddenly realize that the room is ransacked and the couple in bed isn't moving. They turn on a light and quickly understand that the bed is soaked in blood, and while there's spatter all over the room, the concentration of the mess appears to be on the headboard of the bed, where the couple is still lying under a comforter. A closer look reveals that Roger is lying on the far side of the bed, or right side if you're facing it, while Rose is on the near or left side. The comforter covers Roger about midway up its back, while it is pulled up over Rose to the point that only her head is visible above it. Roger is lying face down on the mattress, while Rose is on her back, facing upward, yet both of them have very obviously been bludgeoned by a heavy-bladed weapon strongly believed to be a hatchet, though it could also be something similar. Now, getting back to that idea or theme of splitting one entity into two, or splitting it apart, look at what the weapon is. Something designed to do exactly that. An axe or hatchet is specifically designed to split things in two. So all we have to do is ask this question. If someone was cheating on you in a manner that was splitting you apart, such as an affair that threatens a marriage, what pain would that cause you? Emotional pain, right? And what would be the source of that pain? Meaning, where would you be doing the suffering? Inside your own head. So, in a sociopathic revenge narrative involving the elimination of a threat to split you and your husband apart, one in which emotional pain inside the head is extracted by physical means, we understand the result would be this. The perpetrator would physically split the other two apart and do so by way of causing the pain in the same place they caused it to her, the head. The perpetrator splits apart their heads, which is the physically manifested symbolic equivalent of suffering emotional disunity inside. Now, what do we call it when somebody cheats on you and keeps it a secret, in terms of slang? Well, we often say that person is doing what? Going behind your back. That phrase is obviously intended to elicit thoughts of ignorance, meaning if somebody goes behind your back, they can't be seen doing it. So when we look at the bodies, we should see the manifested equivalent of that is apparent in the murders. And we do. Even though Rose is face up and Roger face down, what's clear is that they were both murdered by being bludgeoned to the back of the head while face down. So if the killer did that, he or she would literally be where? Behind their backs. The investigation shows that the killer stood over the bed, swinging the hatchet horizontally across the vertically oriented bodies on the bed, while leaning over them, which, again, would literally put the killer behind their backs when the pain inside their heads was caused. it mimics, to the best of practicality, sneaking around behind their backs while they're in ignorance and causing them pain, leading to death when they found out about the truth. It replicates the emotional death of the killer finding out the truth that the couple had been split apart, meaning her marriage, and somebody else was now in her place. Of course, once you know a person is cheating or going behind your back, your next question is basically this: who is parked in my spot now? Who has taken my place in this couple? So accordingly, once Rose is killed, they turn her over, which allows her face to be seen and thereby answers, in manifested physicality, the looming question of her identity. When people learn a spouse is cheating, they can sometimes develop a very unhealthy mission of not only learning who has replaced them, but doing so very insecurely, meaning making comparisons that boil down to this idea: what does she have that I don't? For women especially, and even more so back in 1980, that consideration has a lot to do with physical appearance, perhaps above and beyond any other consideration. Is she younger? Is she more beautiful? The person asks those questions to make an assessment that leads to answering why the affair took place. Basically, you're asking, where did I fall short in a place where she succeeded? The answer, more often than not in cases of men cheating, is that the woman in question is perceived as perhaps younger and more attractive. The person who's been hurt emotionally makes a comparison between herself and the lover in an effort to assess the deficit or disparity between what she was offering and what her husband really seemed to want. In the absence of a woman speaking or taking action, such as the reality when she's freshly dead and can't speak or move at all, the only way to make that assessment and do so in the context of clear identification of who she was would be to turn her over and look at her face. Who is she? Is she young? Is she pretty? What does she look like? Do I know her? What does she have that I don't possess? Those questions, when asked of a fully clothed dead person, are most easily and practically answered by the face. And then, if we examine Roger being face down, what does that say? It says she knows what he looks like and who he is, and contrary to Rose's positioning, unwillingness to look at the face says that she's ashamed of what she's done. It's common for people who kill somebody they know, especially somebody they love, to refuse to look after the act. They don't want to see that dead face. Beyond that, if Roger is face down and Rose face up, what does it say very clearly? They're going in opposite directions, not coming together. Or we could say, they're being split apart, like wood on the chopping block. And it's being done in a manner that ensures what? They can't get back together. And there you see the motive for why the perpetrator has done this. She believes this act of cheating has split her apart with her husband, and they are not going to get back together. And we, of course, see that they don't get back together. And finally, what we also can't deny seeing is this idea: what action directly preceded or led to them being killed? Getting in bed together. Now, on that note, let's indulge the manner in which Roger and Rose are dressed. Roger is wearing only his underwear, specifically boxer shorts, while Rose is described as fully dressed in the clothes she had previously been wearing that day. On a practical level, it's very difficult to say why they were dressed like this at the time, as we don't know what transpired to motivate them. For instance, were they followed to their room by somebody who then insisted on entering with them, negating the necessity of knocking and wondering if they'll actually open the door? Was this person perhaps also armed with a gun, intended to provide control and silence, but without ever being fired? Or did they just get a knock at the door, and answered it because they knew the person? Was it Rose who answered, because she had been clothed? Did she get clothed at that time? Or did they not know who it was, and in typical late hitchhiking era fashion, didn't think much of opening the door for a stranger? Again, it's something we don't know because, despite the room being ransacked, there wasn't a sign of a struggle beyond the aforementioned wounds to Roger's fingers. With no struggle, there isn't a narrative for who moved this way or that way, or why it happened. For all intents and purposes, it seems the couple cooperated, something we assume happened because they were scared and believed they might be able to save their lives by doing the right thing and doing it quietly. The door to the room locks automatically from the outside when closed, so it seems most likely that the couple was either followed to their room or opened the door because they knew the person waiting outside it. Perhaps it was a jealous spouse, someone representing that person, or even both. Which brings us to the next phase of our examination, the room. But let's just quickly take a look at the symbolic implications of the way these two are dressed, regardless of what the actual reasons are in practicality. If Roger is wearing boxer shorts and Rose is fully clothed, all areas typically and directly related to sex are covered. Sex is essentially disallowed. And so, on the bed, we find the two clothed, separated, and dead, which was the exact opposite or mirrored value of their intention, something we understand as unclothed, together, and of course, alive. Beyond that, Roger suffers 7 strikes to the back of the head with this bladed object, believed to be a hatchet, crushing his skull and causing massive brain injuries, but ultimately his cause of death becomes blood loss. The same goes for Rose, except that she endured 12 strikes to the back of the head with this sharp object. At first glance, it would seem to indicate Rose was more so the focus of the rage, but given the fact investigators think the killer swung over Roger to hit Rose, it stands to reason that the reduced leverage in swinging the hatchet out like that would result in the necessity to deliver more blows to the same effect. Now, both Rose and Roger suffered a few deep bruises to the back, shoulders, and arms, but as I said earlier, it doesn't seem to be the result of fighting back per se. Rather, it seems that they were reacting to the strikes in a way that caused them to move quite a bit, and then caused the blows intended for the head to go astray and hit the body. If they were trying to fight back, our most primitive instincts would indicate that the first thing they would do is turn over to face their foe. Having your back to a predator is the worst position you can be in to defend yourself. So again, our most primitive instincts of fight or flight, with a mattress directly in front of our bodies and faces, would be to turn over, defend ourselves, and subsequently flee if we were outmatched to an extent that we were going to die, which is likely the case when the perpetrator is armed with no less than a hatchet and perhaps more. So I'll just quickly summarize what I think transpired here. We're told that the room and the personal items of the inhabitants were ransacked prior to the killings, something supported by findings of blood spatter on objects that had been tossed on the floor or removed from Roger's wallet, among other considerations. I think this perpetrator likely staged the scene to appear like a robbery, and being face down, the couple would be ignorant of what he was doing, at least to a certain extent, at the conclusion of such, and likely promising the couple they'd be fine if they cooperated, I think the man surprised Roger with a strike over the head, and though damaged by it, he proceeded to defensively put up a hand, which was quickly struck by the next blow, removing at least his pinky finger and damaging others. By that time, I think he was incapacitated to an extent that he couldn't put up a fight beyond reacting physically to the extreme severity of the blows. Also, I think Rose was probably scared to death and simply cooperated because she didn't realistically believe there was a way out. She was trapped. It seems counterintuitive to our instincts to simply succumb to oncoming death, but it's fairly common that victims overwhelmed by fear refuse to act and instead engage the staunch denial of perhaps being set free if they cooperate, right until the moment it's proven untrue and they end up dead. Not everybody runs. Not everybody fights back. Some perceive themselves as helpless and therefore take no action. Now, look how that mirrors the desires of a person who had been cheated on. What didn't they want, but they got surprised with it anyway? To get hurt, just like what happened to these two lovers. And in what specific way did they get hurt? It was in the process of a robbery in which the victims were to remain ignorant, which means what? Something is taken from you in the absence of your knowledge. So in the same way a quote-unquote robbery is being perpetrated in the room in their ignorance, the perpetrator, or whomever was commissioned by the perpetrator, is saying that something was stolen from her in her ignorance. Her husband. Now, the perpetrator, by taking their lives, controlling the hotel room, and making them obviously unable to drive Rose's car any longer, has eliminated or erased the better part of this narrative, aka taken it back, like it never happened. That's what happens with sociopathic narratives. You erase the past. Now, again, this is like it almost never happened, except there were financial transactions that prove it did. So to symbolically erase those as well, the only thing missing from the room, aside from a small bar of hotel soap that easily could have gone down the drain during a long, thorough cleaning of blood off a person, is $200 cash from Roger's wallet. That's the exact amount of the travel stipend his company gave him for his trip. It basically manifests the idea of Roger not going away with Rose. Why? No other valuables were taken, but at the end, everything related to this trip is erased. In my eyes, this crime was likely commissioned by a jealous spouse. Again, the physical distance these lovers created between themselves and those who know them by going away on a weekend trip, in their ignorance, is also the distance Roger's spouse realized he was willing to go to get away from her, even if only for a short while. What a spouse would see is that she and her husband have been split apart so that her husband and another woman can come together. At that point, the only way to split them apart, because you can't do it emotionally, is to erase the past in a manifested sociopathic narrative in which symbolism allows physicality to replace emotion. Someone went to the hotel room and both literally and physically separated and split apart the lovers, causing pain inside their heads that led to the end of the relationship. That's what happened to this spouse. All things related to the trip are erased to compensate or bring manifested balance to the idea that the past can't be erased from her mind emotionally. So she puts it on a physical palette and erases it there symbolically. Okay, so let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsor. The Girl in Cabin 13 by A.J. Rivers is one of the most compelling novels I've read recently. It's about FBI agent Emma Griffin, who is sent undercover to the small sleepy town of Feathered Nest to uncover the truth behind the string of disappearances that has left the town terrified. When a knock on her door reveals a body on her porch and her name written on a piece of paper in the dead man's hand, suddenly, her worlds collide. Now, she must face what may be her biggest case. In Cabin 13, there lies an uneasy feeling. The feeling of her movements being watched. Turns out the woods have secrets, and this idyllic town has dark and murderous ones. The novel had me hooked to every word. Rivers builds in unexpected twists and plot points that just keep the pages turning. She brilliantly intertwines a chilling mystery, great suspense, witty dialogue, and even some welcomed romance into a story that is almost impossible to not get involved in. With over 16,000 reviews at 4.3 out of 5 stars on Amazon, the book has been incredibly well received. The Girl in Cabin 13 by A.J. Rivers is one of the best novels I've read recently, and I highly recommend that you listen to or read this gripping, suspenseful novel on Amazon, Audible, or iTunes right now. Now, while some see a serial killer here, I see a jealous spouse who commissioned murder and was even perhaps present, as it seems the minutiae of the symbolic narrative is attended to with great specificity. Now, back to the room. There are conflicting reports about the TV being on or off, but it seems confirmed that the drapes were pulled closed. The main room was left dark, except for one lamp being on, which was located bedside on a nightstand. Okay, so we'll start at the desk next to the TV. It's here that the police indicated they believe the perpetrator sat in a chair at some point before or after the murders, presumably to rifle through the victim's stuff. However, we have to consider that the TV is also right next to the desk on a swiveling stand, so if he was seated there with his feet up, it might have been to watch TV. We don't know. Anyhow, on the floor in front of the desk, detectives find a small machine that warms shaving cream into a hot lather. Next to it is Rose's purse. A few items are protruding from the top of the purse, but to the best of our knowledge, nothing was missing from it. Now, if we're facing the bed, the left side has a gap of only a few feet between the bed and the wall. In there, they find two suitcases and a pair of shoes, or boots. Beyond that is the nightstand where the light was left on. Below the lamp on that nightstand is a phone. And then the top and bottom drawers on the nightstand are pulled open. On the other side of the bed, or right side, we have a nightstand with a lamp that is off. His checkbook is out, and somebody has scribbled on it with a bar of soap. On the floor, the contents of Roger's wallet are strewn about, as though they were individually removed from it. Photos, receipts, and more. But very strangely, the police find what seems to be shards of orange soap belonging to a bar from the bathroom, as though someone whittled it down and then stomped the shards into the carpet. Now, if you whittle something, physically, what are you doing that lends itself to the reason one would take revenge? You're making a point. So let me supply an example here of somebody trying to make a big point, and then we'll come right back to this. I might have mentioned this scene from a TV show in the past, and it's because the writing is just fantastic. Anyhow, in the HBO show Boardwalk Empire, for those who aren't familiar, there's a character named Chalky White, who is, ironically, a black man. Chalky, as opposed to most people who look like him back in 1923, is wealthy, powerful, and respected, a guy who wears expensive tailored suits on the exterior to maximize his sophisticated look, but beneath the facade, he's still just a guy from out in the country who doesn't possess a real education or cultured presentation conducive to forgetting where he came from. He only has street smarts. He's a gangster. Inside, he's still that person from back home, but he's afforded his wife and children a life of luxury that has turned them into people with whom he no longer relates very well. It's what any father or husband would want, of course, to give his family a better life. But the irony in doing so is that the money and privilege makes his family different. One night, while sitting at the dinner table and meeting his daughter's new boyfriend, Chalky is denied a dish called Hoppin' John that he requested, and he finds himself dissatisfied with the seemingly more sophisticated food being served. His family members are embarrassed that he wants to serve the dish and think it's not only beneath them, but below the standards of the daughter's boyfriend, who is a med student. Chalky did everything he could to lift them up in terms of class, and when he did, in some ways, he got left behind. So while the intention was truly for his family to forget where they come from and move on to greener pastures, it also makes him angry that the result is them thinking less of him, not more. He provided a life so good that they began to look down on him and feel ashamed of who he is because while he was busy going out into the world and providing, they were busy reaping the rewards for themselves and class climbing without him. So he freaks out at the table and storms out of the house because they simply cannot understand why he is so deeply connected to the past. This exit from the home symbolically and literally makes him an outsider, manifesting what they did to him emotionally inside. So he goes outside so that he can say to them, "You put me on the outside looking in," because that's what they were doing. They were whittling him down to a place where, beneath the facade of his sophisticated armor, in a location where he was emotionally vulnerable, where he was raw and bare, their words hurt him. So because they do that to him emotionally, he goes outside, finds a big stick you could almost call a branch, and uses a knife to whittle it down, removing the bark to reveal the very sensitive, raw, and previously unseen wood beneath it, which had never been exposed before. But more than anything else, what the process of whittling is about is making a point. So because the family hurt Chalky with their sharp words, and they didn't understand the point he was trying to make emotionally, he compensates by getting even through the process of literally making a very big point that could physically hurt someone instead of emotionally damaging a person. He wasn't able to make his point emotionally or intellectually, so he goes outside and manifests that point into reality to be as sharp physically as their words were to him emotionally. And in that, we see the emotional issue inside the house projected into physicality outside it, just as happens with your brain creating images from emotion that appear before your eyes. The images we see are projections of our emotions and not the other way around. Our construction projects emotion into images, but our perception is designed to do the opposite, which is believe emotion is derived from what already happened. And obviously because we see or experience something and only then become emotional about it. In reality, those two things are coordinated in the sense that the image is projected to accommodate the upcoming emotion. It's the emotion that necessitates the image and not the other way around. But if you are going to feel something, first you must experience it. Therefore, from the standpoint of experience, yes, the images precede the emotion, but within the context of construction, the emotion precedes the images. So in this scene, Chalky first experiences the emotion and then inserts symbolic imagery to show not only what he wanted and why, but more specifically, and how it pertains to this case, how they managed to hurt him. He wanted to make a point. They wanted to make a point. He got hurt emotionally by their point, and they didn't understand his, so to compensate, he went outside physically to make a point. So in this case, we ask, what is getting whittled down to make a point, and why? Well, again, that bar of orange hotel soap is the item that gets whittled into shards to make a point. And just like Chalky had something to say, so will this killer. Now, if Chalky is projecting the physicality of an emotional idea back at the people who hurt him to help them understand what they've done, what could we call that? Well, we could say he's mirroring. Like I've said, the mirror universe is your physical reality projected back at your emotional world. It's where the things in your head take shape physically outside it. All change happens inside your head, but outside it is the place where images are rendered to support that emotional movement. So, the mirror universe is the place in which the cleansing occurs, and that cleansing essentially amounts to the idea of the cleansing of sin by way of transformation. Like Chalky carved the bark from the outside of the stick to reveal the raw, vulnerable truth hidden beneath, so too must we go through life shedding our armor, or ego, by way of a cleansing that reveals the truth about who we really are, most aptly defined as who we're becoming. Because life is only about change, and therefore transcendence is the basis for it. So here, as we understand, the soap might have been used practically for the purpose of removing fingerprints, we also notice it's whittled down for another purpose: to make a point. And where? On a mirror. The soap was used to make a point in the form of writing a message on the bathroom mirror hanging on the back of the door. It started with the word "this," but the words written thereafter were wiped away and illegible. So the meaning we can infer from "this," given that the word is written on the glass, is that the mirror was the reason why this happened. It occurred because, in sociopathy, to succeed, you have to mirror your emotional suffering with the physical suffering of others in order to restore balance. So, what started as a longer message was soon reduced to only one word because everything written after that word was actually unnecessary. Now, what do we see screaming for attention within all those considerations? Well, the person whittled that writing down to one word, a single sharp point. Like Chalky, they mirrored their emotional pain physically. And again, in sociopathic fashion, what happens to the words? They're erased. And what it says, more than anything else, is a reflection of what the perpetrator wants. Think about that word again and how it was erased. Now, think of how the lovers had plans ahead that were erased. Like the plans were erased, the word "this" has everything after it erased so that when you read it, it specifically and literally shows you that there is nothing after this. Nothing after this. It says she erased their plans moving forward from that moment, and their relationship is over, and it's done in front of a mirror showing her, because those consequences, due to how they affect her as well, mean that her relationship is over. So for her, in the context of the relationship, there is also nothing after this. That's why it's mirrored. It has a dual context. Now, let's follow that soap into the bathroom, which is clearly going to be, again, our mirror universe or abyss of change in which that cleansing manifests. So, in the bathroom, there is one bloody towel draped over the counter next to the sink. There is yet another on the floor, and also one more resting on the bottom of the dry bathtub. I believe it's the towel by the sink from which investigators are eventually able to recover unknown male DNA, and to this point have not found it able to be used in a manner that identifies anybody. We have to remember this is 1980, and a killer would only be concerned with fingerprints. However, they did find one fingerprint they believe is connected to the crime, meaning it likely belongs to the killer. Now, as I've talked about in past episodes, evolution is facilitated through a binary process quite similar to our political systems in the sense that the red giant and blue wave give way to each other on an alternating basis. The red giant is essentially conservatism, meaning lack of change, which causes the circle to swell. In order to evolve, you have to break the circle, or red giant, by utilizing the reduction of the cooling blue wave of progress. The red giant is lack of movement, or stagnancy, even death ultimately, and so once the red giant swells, again, it has to be broken to release the contents, which then move in a straight line of progress forward from that place until they stop and repeat the same, over and over again, into perpetuity. So, another example I've used is the bloated red sun rising and falling over the horizon to appear or disappear as the blue wave on the ocean rides over it to mimic the cooling effect. In the morning, as heat rises, the red giant overtakes the blue wave, and at night, as things cool, the blue wave overtakes the red giant, over and over. Now, when the blue wave peaks, meaning when it's set to come crashing down over the red giant, what would we call that action, and how does it relate to the idea of a cleansing? Well, when a wave does that, it's called a crest. And when that wave crests, having swallowed the red giant, what happens is that the action of cresting causes foam to appear on the shallow surface of the water near the shoreline, in which the water then seems white moving forward. So inside this bathroom, it's not a coincidence that we see some very weird things transpiring involving a tube of what type of toothpaste? Crest. Now, you can even Google this if you like, but in 1980, Crest toothpaste featured its name written like this. The C, which symbolizes a broken circle, is the largest letter, and also red, symbolizing the red giant, which gives way to the remainder of the name Crest being written in blue letters, symbolizing the blue wave of the cleansing that follows the red giant. And then beyond that, just as happens when the wave crests in the ocean and makes the water foam, the area becomes white on the tube. So, now that the circle, or red giant, has been broken in a manifested way, meaning the heads have been cracked by the hatchet to release the copious blood flow, the pooling of blood symbolizes that the oncoming blue wave will wash you clean of that sin afterward. Now, in this case, we see that we have someone quite literally following the path of a cleansing, not only in terms of cleaning up, but also symbolically, and that suggests this person is under the impression that he or she is culpable for these gruesome sins. That would indicate we might be talking about a believer, like Roger's wife. Now, what the actual blue wave leading to white foam and then disappearing represents is the coming of the Father, in any context, right down to sexuality, specifically ejaculation. And just like you see in the word crest with the letter C, Once you break the circle in the red giant, the blue wave to follow allows you to rest or cool off by causing the red giant to recede. So just think about what you would do at night. You would go to sleep. And so when the sun goes down at night, the red giant recedes beneath the blue wave and you then rest. Our emotions work the same way. And therefore, when someone gets angry and kills another person, we get the massive pool of blood followed by the cleansing of the blue wave in the form of water. So here we have bloody towels to suggest the red giant has just occurred, something that also happens, if you will, during a menstrual cycle. Now, the importance of mentioning this is that the red giant is created in the uterus in the form of a blood-based lining that acts as the basis for what will become the womb for a fetus if impregnated. But if that blood-based lining, or red giant, goes unused, then what happens is that it goes to the extent of its mass before breaking or collapsing in the menstrual cycle, at which point it's ejected from the body onto something that is usually, but not always, a straight white line, whether it's a tampon or a pad. Anyhow, the point of discussing this is that those bloodied items say one thing. Nobody became the father. That's what the menstrual cycle means. So if we follow the procession of bloody towels to the place in which it intersects with the toothpaste, we'll be able to understand what all of this means. The first towel by the sink says, I have blood on my hands, and the person cleanses himself or herself of that idea, followed by the bloody towel on the floor saying, because of this blood on my hands, I have fallen from grace and hit rock bottom, symbolized by the hard porcelain floor. Porcelain is made in a kiln at extremely high temperatures, so like the red giant, a cooling or cleansing process must follow, and due to that, we find the final or third bloody towel in the tub, a place of cleansing consistent with the usage of soap from earlier. In the bathtub, next to the towel, are multiple squirts of Crest toothpaste. Now, a tube of toothpaste obviously manifests the idea of male ejaculation as you squeeze this phallic object and the toothpaste shoots out. Of course, anatomically, in the case of a penis, it's designed to ejaculate these squirts upward into the body. So, if you want to manifest the idea of not becoming or being the father, as we see with the bloody towels, in which direction would you squirt the toothpaste? Down rather than up. So here we see toothpaste squirted downward multiple times like ejaculate away from the killer instead of toward her. What this person is saying is that she wants to undo someone being the father, meaning she wants to erase it like she did with the narrative of the lover's weekend getaway. Again, remember our phases of birth, life, death, deity, at which point the father disembodies or disappears. In this narrative, after Roger, a father who is cheating on his wife, disembodies and essentially disappears, the person who killed him proceeds to indulge the process of symbolically walking back their history together as though she erased their relationship and the child produced. It's the same thing again that she did with the weekend getaway. Once he's dead, we have a cleansing in which it is expressed that someone is no longer the father, symbolically relieving her of motherhood as their history together has been erased. So again, to symbolize him not being the father and her not being the mother, the killer manifests a circumstance in which we have a trail of ejaculate, aka squirts of toothpaste, outside the body instead of inside it, and shows us bloody towels next to that and in a trail leading away from it, to say she continued on her way, periodically leaving behind bloody towels, aka not being pregnant. Now, why is toothpaste, aside from the practicality of squirting it, used in this instance? What does it say to us about a cleansing? Now, if someone lied to you with their mouth that needed a cleansing, and those lies caused emotional pain, what might you do in response to getting hurt emotionally? You might cry. Now, if a person knows someone is cheating and cries over it, how might that person say, in a symbolic way, that the person knows their partner is lying because they've seen it? Well, the tube of toothpaste, after being squirted into the tub, is then stuffed into a box of tissues in the bathroom. What does that say? Well, we already know this toothpaste tube is symbolizing a penis, so she stuffs it in the tissue box to insinuate that his infidelity is what made her cry. Now, what are tissues most often used for? The eyes and the nose. It says she has been crying her eyes out because she sees the truth and she knows. Basically, in the crudest way possible, his penis is what made her cry, and this act of nullifying the penis and everything it did to hurt her means that she'll cry no more. So the toothpaste tube, serving as the penis, thereby prevents tissues from coming out, meaning it will make her cry no more. And if anyone right now is thinking that this symbolism is a bridge too far, let me follow that by saying that a certain somebody showed up at a family member's house the day before Roger's death and broke down into tears while talking about him before shrugging it off as nothing and refusing to elaborate upon why the tearful breakdown happened in the first place. Now, Marcella also has a daughter with Roger, explaining the desire to reverse course symbolically on the pregnancy, like she did on that weekend getaway, in an effort to erase it. Of course, symbolism is also used to deflect guilt, and here we have a very strong narrative that negates the idea of the father or fatherhood. So, what about Roger's wife, Marcella? Is it possible she conspired with him, meaning her father, to commit this act? There were, in fact, two chairs pulled bedside during the murders that otherwise would have been in different places. Two chairs could easily mean two perpetrators. Well, when Marcella was asked if perhaps she committed this crime, she said she did not, but proceeded to shock everybody by suggesting that she believed it was possible that someone she knew had committed it. And when she named that person, just take a guess who it was. Her father. She said she thought it was possible her father committed the crime in her ignorance, but the scene bears symbolic resonance, strongly connecting them both. This isn't the type of evidence that lands you in the slammer, of course, but it doesn't take a genius to reason that the most likely cause of Roger's and Rose's death was related to literally fucking around and finding out. Most people are killed by someone they know, and if you're in the midst of a weekend getaway with your lover and find yourselves bludgeoned by a hatchet-wielding maniac, it's probably because you pissed somebody off in a way that they felt was irreconcilable. Now, with that said, let's examine this. While both Roger and Marcella were devout Christians, they differed in their faith, at least in one very specific area. Roger was not opposed to divorce and had reportedly even asked Marcella for a divorce in the past, something she refused as she was on the opposite end of the spectrum. Her faith didn't permit getting a divorce. But in taking that stance, look what happened to her. Her husband was making regular attempts to cheat on her, even going to the extent of manipulating women with faulty phone installations to be sure he could deceive people in an effort to get what he wanted. and look at the symbolic resonance of what he created in physicality that matches the emotions. Faulty connections. These encounters with other women are problematic. Even the communication with his wife is lacking, unclear, and distant. So I think Roger's wife was unwilling to divorce him, and while it's rumored she would read him scripture from the Bible that shunned the idea of divorce to prove her point, I think the underlying truth is that she simply did not want to lose him to anyone else. So instead of emotionally going through a divorce implemented by her that allowed Roger to be with another woman, or even women plural, moving forward, I believe Marcella commissioned someone to cut short the emotional fallout with physicality. If someone cheats on you, there can be feelings of jealousy, rejection, and more. I think she wanted, more than anything else, to put an end to it. Between the lies coming out of his mouth and his penis coming out of his pants, she wanted to cry no more. She wanted to end that suffering. And when we want the pain to stop, we wish for one thing and one thing only. For our problems to disappear, to go away and never return to haunt us. So ultimately, I believe these killings were motivated by a jealous spouse. Yet with that said, it's worth mentioning the other suspects. However, before we do, let's return to what Marcella said about believing her father could be the killer. That's not the important part. What we need to examine is in the subtext of what she says. In suggesting that her father could have been the killer, she admits that her father would have known where Roger and Rose were going to be that weekend. If Roger was hiding that specific location from his wife, yet she believed her dad would know it, we must ask first, how would he know? And then follow with asking, if he did know, then how would she be aware that he did, unless he told her? The easiest, most likely answer to the question is they conspired in some way to learn. It's rumored that the company where Roger worked was notorious for married men having affairs with customers. So all it would take in 1980, pre-cell phone, pre-smartphone, and even pre-caller ID, is to call his office trying to catch up with him under the guise of being somebody else, such as a client, and having a coworker reveal where he was going that weekend. Roger was indulging both business and pleasure, so to divulge any part of his business plan to a male caller probably wouldn't draw suspicion. The wife is the person who needs to be deceived, and not other men, so if a man, such as Marcella's father, under the guise of being someone else, called about Roger, it's likely he could have at least acquired information that would approximate Roger's whereabouts, allowing him to follow them. The toothpaste angle has led some to believe the killer is a random heroin addict, as addicts with sexual dysfunction sometimes simulate orgasm in the absence of being able to have one, and a method sometimes used is squeezing a tube of toothpaste to make it shoot out. Yet, how often does a heroin addict refrain from taking all the money available at the scene during a robbery? How many heroin addicts are like, I should kill these people so I can rob them, but then leave money behind in the woman's purse so that I can't fulfill my addiction? Cash is king to an addict. If they kill to get money, they don't leave it behind. In a legitimate robbery involving an addict, anything of value inside Rose's purse would have disappeared. It didn't. It was ignored. Now here's the deal with the bartender who allegedly had an argument with Rose. He left town in his truck the next day and got rid of the truck in Iowa City before heading to the East Coast and soon after joining the army, going to Germany. He never bothered to go back to work at the bar or collect a final paycheck. it sounds like he was in a hurry to get away, and when later questioned, the man stated that he did in fact leave because of the murders. Not because he committed them, he said, but because, as a transient man living out of his truck and working as a hotel bartender who got into an argument with one of the deceased parties, he felt the act would certainly be blamed on him. Law enforcement has supposedly interviewed this person as many as 10 times since the incident, and while his circumstances are certainly interesting as far as drawing suspicion, there doesn't ever seem to have been a time in which the police believed this man was guilty of the crimes. We're told that he passed a polygraph and that there is no physical evidence to place him at the scene. Of course, while some believe the murder weapon came right off the wall at the farming-themed hotel, which featured instruments all over the walls, nobody ever noticed one missing. I believe this hatchet was not part of the decor and was most likely carried into the building by the perpetrator inside a bag that, in a hotel, would look like nothing more than somebody transporting their clothes in and out. I see a premeditated murder involving calculation derived from elements of conspiracy and not the desperation of a drug addict looking for money and a thrill kill. I see this as personal, not just angry. Rage is directed at them, and that rage seems consistent with somebody the victims already hurt. That doesn't describe a stranger. Now here's where it gets really interesting for me. You might be wondering why I believe Marcella's father would be capable of murder, and willing, without even knowing much about him, if anything at all. Well, one of the suspects in this case is a vicious serial killer, someone named Charles Ray Hatcher, who admitted to killing 16 people between 1969 and 1982. Authorities believed he could be the man responsible, as he had escaped from a mental institution just prior to or just after the killings in September 1980. Now, why on earth would anyone connect these deaths to Charles Ray Hatcher, who was later learned to have been working at a restaurant in Omaha, Nebraska, under a false name? Well, Hatcher was not only Marcella's uncle, but more importantly, he was her father's brother. There was already a serial killer in the family. This man's own brother. And so, while that certainly doesn't make Marcella's father a killer, it does suggest that the capacity for such is inherent in his familial genetics. That could possibly predispose him to a similar type of behavior. We don't know. Now, men at Rogers' company were also considered persons of interest because they not only knew where Roger was going that weekend, but these installers also carried machetes in their cars to jobs in the event brush needed to be removed. Investigators felt there was a possibility of the murder weapon being a machete, but that it was more likely a hatchet. In addition, leading up to the murders, Rose claimed her ex-boyfriend, Danny Burton, whom she had recently thrown out of her home, was stalking her. She had seen him and another man following her in a brown van and also parked down the street from her home. She supposedly went to the police a few weeks before her death and said, "If anything happens to me, it was Danny Burton." Which sounds really convincing until you consider that she was playing with fire somewhere else by sleeping with a married man. Rose had seemingly purchased a dog specifically to use as protection from this man, and strangely enough, after the murders, that dog disappeared as well, having been taken from a screened-in porch. Ultimately, however, Burton provided what police say is a legitimate alibi for the night of the killings, and he also passed a polygraph test. It's thought that, contrary to the tale that is told, the dog might have just gotten out on its own. Finally, the most interesting suspect of all is probably a guy named Raimundo Esparza. He was a transient alcoholic, drug addict, and mental patient. In June 1980, Esparza had allegedly been witnessed by multiple people at a hotel restaurant in which he was carrying a tool bag containing tools he had used when working as a farmhand in Mississippi in the past. Of course, that mattered because a man named William Kyle had been bludgeoned to death at this hotel that night, and the place was only 130 miles or so from the Amana Holiday Inn. Kyle was discovered in bed, specifically hanging off it, and something familiar had been squirted next to his leg. Toothpaste. It seemed a chair had also been pulled up to the bed, and like we saw with Roger's wallet, somebody emptied the contents of William Kyle's wallet onto the floor, piece by piece. And then there's this. In searching through Esparza's past, investigators learned that he was also in the area of a similar case in Mississippi back in October 1970, in which a 20-something man named Jack McDonald was bludgeoned on a bed in a hotel room. In that event, the police discovered two chairs pulled up next to the bed, and some toothpaste had been squirted into the toilet. Unfortunately, there was never anything more than circumstantial evidence implicating Raimundo Esparza in those earlier cases, and he didn't confess. Beyond that, there doesn't seem to be a witness who places him at the Amana Holiday Inn the night that Roger and Rose were murdered, though I did read from one source that there was. There seemed to be conflicting reports, but the overwhelming majority of these reports do not mention any type of witness seeing Esparza at the hotel that night. So, do these consistencies suggest his guilt, or are they just coincidental? We might never know, as Esparza passed away in 1983. Given the nature of the circumstance at play, I lean toward a known perpetrator or perpetrators rather than a stranger, as the details seem incredibly personal to me. Is it possible someone else's symbolic narrative is playing out in places where I see Roger's wife? Of course. But again, given the fact that Roger is actively engaged in cheating at the time, I think the motive is both stronger, clearer, and more likely when applied to his wife, Marcella. Again, I think she most likely commissioned the crime, and if it was carried out by more than one person, it might have been her father and an associate, such as another family member, or even herself, paired with her father in order to confront Roger personally. For me, Marcella suggesting that she believed her father had done it implied that he would know where Roger was in a situation in which he shouldn't have, which says Marcella likely conspired with him to acquire that info, as she would otherwise have no cause whatsoever to make that baseless assumption. I do find Raimundo Esparza to be a compelling suspect, and he certainly could be the man at fault, given the consistencies. But in totality, this crime strikes me as personal. More than anything, I think the responsible party was hurt by the victims. If we look back at the other two murders in comparison to this case, we also see differences aside from those consistencies. We see that there was writing on the bathroom mirror. We see a very big difference in terms of the victims, with there being a man and a woman rather than just a man. So as much as there are many consistencies, and the toothpaste aspect is the sexiest part of it, meaning that's the thing that really draws our eyes as being unique, I do think that it's not enough to say that Raimundo Esparza was the guy in the absence of further evidence. However, in the end, I see the motive as revenge and Marcella as the one seeking it. So at the culmination of this road, I think the one thing that strikes me more than anything else is the lengths we'll go to not tell each other the truth about how we feel because somebody might get hurt. We're so afraid of loss. We're terrified that something might change us. And yet, in our ignorance, that relentless pursuit of never causing harm often destroys all that we love rather than saving it. Roger and Rose drove 4 hours to accommodate this goal by leaving a trail of breadcrumbs called lies in their wake. But as it always does, the truth finally caught up with them.